Welcome to the podcast of The Diane Rehm Show, smart conversation and civil dialogue from WAMU and NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
And thanks for joining us. I'm Frank Sesno of CNN and George Washington University, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. She's home recovering from pneumonia, plans to be back on the air as soon as possible, and thanks all of you for your good wishes. Well, each year, the Food and Drug Administration oversees more than $1 trillion worth of products sold in this country, from produce to microwave ovens, makeup to prescription drugs, scalpels to breast implants. Recent food contamination scares and prescription drug controversies have raised some concerns over how the agency is handling its mandate. Joining me this hour, Janet Woodcock. She's Deputy Commissioner and Chief Medical Officer at the FDA. Reporter Gardner Harris of the New York Times, and by phone from San Francisco, former FDA Commissioner David Kessler. Good day to you all.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Hi, how are you? Well, Janet Woodcock, let's start with you. As I mentioned a moment ago, the FDA truly reaches into all of our lives in any number of ways. Food, drugs, medical devices, cosmetics, vaccines, pacemakers, even contact lenses and dietary supplements, not to mention things like animal feed. Now, in December, the Senate finally confirmed its new FDA commissioner, Dr. Andrew von Eschenbach. So the question to start us off here is, what are the new priorities? Are there new priorities at the FDA?
Yeah, Dr. von Eschenbach is starting out with a very strong set of priorities. He's interested in making sure we have the best possible management of all these agency activities, supported by the most modern science. And that combination of very good management and a good science, we think, will move us forward into this next century.
So you're saying the priority is just to run the place better?
Run the place better, buttressed by the incredible emerging science that we're seeing that's coming out of 30 years of investment in biomedical research. We have new tools that can help us everywhere from food safety to drug safety to animal feed, every single regulatory activity that the agency does.
All right, well, we'll get into some of those, the future and the present and the past. But, Gardner, let's speak of one of the priorities. Legislation pending in the House and Senate recently passed that would give the FDA authority to do something that's an old product, if you will, tobacco, to regulate tobacco products. Is this going anywhere?
It is, and it will likely pass this year, is the betting. It in fact passed in the Senate, I think, 2 years ago, and then got nowhere in the House because of the Republican leadership there. But, of course, it's a different ballgame now. And your other guest, Dr. Kessler, knows quite a bit about this. He's been fighting for this for, what is it, Dr. Kessler, 15 years?
Pretty close.
Well, before I get to Dr. Kessler, because I want him to give us some background on this, Gardner Harris, what exactly does this legislation put on the FDA with respect to tobacco?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, so there is still a fair amount of negotiation going on Capitol Hill, but there is basically the betting is that FDA will begin to regulate ads, for instance, that we might be going closer to a sort of a Canadian system where, you know, you get these kind of plain boxes where there might be some difficulty launching any new products. Actually, one of the largest makers of tobacco products, the maker of Marlboro, is actually in favor of this legislation because they're betting that it will be very difficult to displace them at the top of the pile after this legislation passes, because it will limit advertising. It will limit it will essentially freeze in place the present tobacco structure.
So, Dr. Kessler, this was your big battle cry, or one of them, when you were at FDA. What now?
Well, it was. We worked for over a decade try to get regulation of tobacco. FDA regulates everything else that comes in contact with the body, everything that's put on our skin, everything that we ingest, all the medicine we take.
Why didn't it happen then?
Well, it didn't happen for 100 years because the industry was just too powerful. So I think Gardner is right. I think there is a very high likelihood, and I think it not only will, but it should. Tobacco will finally be a regulated product.
Okay, you're not there anymore. You don't have to deal with the politics. So if you were to take the politics of tobacco out of it, which is just about impossible, what would you have the FDA do?
Well, I think what we want to do is to reduce the access to the product to young people, to reduce the appeal, and then look at the product itself. We have never before looked at the product, what actually is in tobacco before, and the nicotine, and whether that actually should be changed.
Janet Woodcock? What does the FDA want?
We can't, of course, comment on pending legislation. But, of course, we realize, and probably no one more than Dr. von Eschenbach, who is head of the National Cancer Institute, that tobacco causes a tremendous amount of harm, not just cancer, but many other serious illnesses in this country. And from a public health standpoint, minimizing use of tobacco by our population, especially starting smoking or use of other tobacco products by young people, has to be an extremely important public health priority.
Well, now, Dr. von Eschenbach, as a matter of fact, not only headed the Cancer Institute, but he's a 3-time cancer survivor himself. I remember talking to him about that, and he made a reference to when he first learned that he was diagnosed with cancer, wondering if he would see his daughter get married. So how does someone like this bring his personal experience into a discussion about whether his agency is going to regulate tobacco? I mean, he's expressed some skepticism about getting into the regulation business with respect to tobacco. Why?
Well, I think they're separate issues. One is, how can this best be accomplished, and how do you go about accomplishing minimizing people's exposure to tobacco? But the public health issue itself is extremely clear, which is we should do everything possible to prevent young people from starting smoking.
Well, how about this question? And people would ask it. If you're an agency that's out there to regulate the drugs and food that come in contact with people so we don't die from them, if we've got a product here that kills people, why doesn't the FDA or somebody else just ban it altogether?
Well, it's not within the FDA's purview, as Dr. Kessler can tell you very clearly at the moment.
Dr. Kessler?
Well, you know, I think the goal would be to reduce the number of people who smoke as much as we can. The problem with a ban is that it won't work. There are 25 million people who smoke, many of whom are addicted, and an outright ban will probably just lead to a black market. We've been through that before centuries ago with alcohol. But the goal has to be to reduce the number of people who smoke to as few as possible.
Gardner?
Well, what's interesting, Frank, is Janet has been there for a long time. I think in an interview with Bloomberg TV, Dr. von Eschenbach said the other day that he was not sure that regulating tobacco would be such a great thing from FDA's standpoint. I mean, I think it'll be really interesting to see what this administration does in response to possible legislation on Capitol Hill.
You want to give us any indication of that?
No,
And why is Dr. von Eschenbach dragging his feet, essentially? Or that certainly seems to be what it sounds like on this subject.
Yeah, I think he was simply saying, what is the right structure for this? Is the FDA the right agency for this? And so forth and so on. I don't think he was commenting on the public health issues.
But if the FDA is the right agency to regulate all these other things, it's utterly logical, is it not, that it would be the right agency to regulate tobacco?
Of course, that's up to Congress to decide.
We looked at that very hard when we started this, and we looked at all the other agencies. We looked at the NIH, the CDC, the Federal Trade Commission. And I think it's very clear when you go through and you look at the expertise and the scientific and regulatory expertise. There is no agency better than FDA to regulate this product.
And what's really going on here, Frank, is I grew up cutting tobacco on our family farm. And even now, just across the border from Kentucky, from where my father grew up and I spent summers, Tennessee is about to come up with a smoking ban. I mean, the politics on tobacco, which would have been unimaginable a decade ago, the New York Times has a story about that today. I mean, the politics on tobacco have completely shifted. It is clear that there is a real problem here, and I think Capitol Hill is going to do something about it.
Time? Timing?
It's going to be this summer. Janet, you have thoughts on that?
I don't.
All right, well, we'll watch for this summer. Let me turn the subject here to another story that just last week the Washington Post featuring a front-page ad saying the FDA headed toward approving a very controversial antibiotic for animals. And it said the approval could come, and I'm quoting from the article now, despite warnings from health groups and a majority of the agency's own expert advisors that the decision will be dangerous for people. Janet Woodcock, what's going on here?
Well, I think that story was run in advance of FDA making any decision. So this is almost like saying, well, we're going to start arresting you because you were thinking about speeding. We have not made a decision on this. We're taking all the facts into account, and we will certainly...
This antibiotic is called Sefquinone, right?
Right.
And it's one of many types of antibiotics that can be administered to cattle. From what I understand, it's not necessary, but anytime you put an antibiotic out there, it raises the prospects that you can have microbes that become resistant to it. So is this a no-brainer as some would suggest?
All these things, when you look into them from a scientific point of view and from the needs of the different groups, are more complicated than they appear on the surface, maybe on the front page of the paper.
Gardner, what's the pushback on this? The suggestion that politics and conflicts of interest are being brought to bear?
I mean, I don't think so. I think what FDA is struggling with right now is what does it do about antibiotics for cattle and for livestock generally? Basically, there's an argument to be made that any antibiotic used in animals could potentially hurt people by increasing resistance, increasing the number of resistant pathogens. So on the other hand, obviously antibiotics in cattle can be very effective in terms of helping them be healthy animals. So you have this very difficult balance, as FDA is frequently faced with in many other issues, and it's uncertain what they'll do in this case.
Right, and coming up, more of our conversation about the Food and Drug Administration and all the ways it touches your lives. Stay with us. And welcome back. I'm Frank Sesno of CNN and George Washington University, sitting in for Diane Rehm. A moment ago before our break, we were talking about the approval process at FDA for drugs, some of them quite controversial. In this particular case, one antibiotic for animals that some say could be dangerous if we look at human health. Dr. David Kessler, former FDA commissioner, does this issue raise concerns for you?
I think animal drugs are some of the most complicated decisions that the FDA makes because it's not about the safety of the animal alone. It's the fact that these animals are, in fact, they provide food to humans, and it's the downstream consequences. But it's really not animal drugs today that I think are on everyone's mind. It's human drugs, and there's been a lot of controversy, and the FDA has had a lot of challenges of late with regard to approving drugs for humans.
What makes you most uncomfortable in all of this?
Well, I think there's no better public servant, there's no better doc anywhere than Janet Woodcock. But I think back in 2005, she said, in her words, the nation's drug safety system had pretty much broken down. The Institute of Medicine instituted 25 recommendations recently directed at Congress, at HHS, at FDA itself. It cited organizational problems. It cited inadequate quantity and quality of post-approval data. The Vioxx episode, I think, significantly shook everybody. I mean, for the first time, you had a drug that had a potential mortality, I mean, that had not been seen before. We still don't fully understand that. But doctors are saying to me, for the first time, I'm hearing, can I trust FDA?
I mean, that is a huge question. And Janet Woodcock, I'm going to put that to you. Let's also point out that coming against the backdrop of all the stuff that we're seeing from the Veterans Affairs and what happened at Walter Reed has undermined the public's trust in government to do the right thing and do what it's expected to do. In the case of the FDA, where you are regulating so much that's so directly tied to our health and well-being, questions of trust, as Dr. Kessler mentions, coming from doctors themselves is astounding and deeply disturbing.
Yes, we have to maintain the trust because we're making decisions that affect all Americans. And health professionals have to rely upon the FDA to make sure that all those health products are safe and effective and that they're going to work for them.
Well, if you yourself said the system or parts of it were broken, mm-hmm. what's being done to fix it? Is it fixed yet?
What's happened, and we have to step back a little bit, but...
You said it was broken.
Yes.
Do you still think it's broken?
We as a society, not the agency. When I said that in 2005, I was not impugning FDA and its efforts, all right? As a society, we have failed to face the fact that times have changed and medical practice has changed. Back 30, 40 years ago, if you got really sick, all right, they put you in the hospital. And if they couldn't operate on you, basically you would pray. That was about all you could do, right? Nowadays, we have a huge number of interventions, both medical devices and medicines. And we rely upon those to cure the ill and to keep people healthy and prevent illness. But our systems were put into place back in that time when we only had a few medicines available.
What's really going on here, Frank? Janet has been digging quarters out of the couches at FDA for years to try to patch together a system to check the safety of old medicines. It's called the AIRS system. It's the best they've got, but it's a horrible system. And basically, the FDA has no ability to check whether old drugs and old devices are working as safely as they might be. And what really has to happen here is that Congress and the administration have to step up with more money, and that's unlikely.
I'd like to go to the phones in just a moment. But first, Dr. Kessler, broken system. If you were able to fix it, or if anybody could, what should they be doing?
I don't think it's about FDA alone. I think it's, in fact, has a lot to do with the way we develop drugs. Over the last decade, the pharmaceutical industry got in the model of developing blockbuster drugs. They really got in the habit of wanting drugs that they could sell to millions and millions and millions of people, and they developed machinery that once they got a drug approved, they put it through that machinery, and their sales and marketing force, direct-to-consumer marketing, and they had literally millions of people taking the drug. The fact is blockbusters are going to raise problem. What we need to move to is a system of not drugs for the masses, but the right dose of a drug, the right indication, the right patient, the right time.
But now you're talking about differences in the way the pharmaceutical companies are going to do business. They make the billions with the drugs for the masses.
I think that's where the real issue. When you sell a drug to millions of patients, of course you're going to see safety problems.
So who changes the way that's done? Is that the FDA that changes the way that's done? Or are you asking the pharmaceutical companies to voluntarily change the way they do business and make less money?
It's not about making less money. It's about the right drug, right dose, for the right patient at the right time.
All right, Janet Woodka.
Yeah, if I can jump in here, the FDA's shown a tremendous amount of leadership on this. We know that one size doesn't fit all for pharmaceuticals, and that the drug that works for you may not work for me, or it may harm me, but be great for other people. And we have been really pushing the concept of personalized medicine over the last 4 years, and I think we're getting a tremendous amount of traction on that.
Okay, let me go to the phones here for just a minute. Aaron from Ohio, who I think would jump into this part of the conversation. Hello, Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, as you guys briefly touched on, I'm a college student right now, and I've been becoming increasingly concerned with my safety in general, and when I hear things about, not really recently, but maybe, you know, Bayer selling blood clotting drugs that infect thousands of people with AIDS and they don't get punished at all, and aspartame being approved and then denied and then approved, and I guess my question would just be, how could you convince me that, you know, my safety is here, you know, that you're here for my safety and I don't have to worry about these kinds of things.
Janet Woodcock, what do you say to that? How do you convince Aaron and others that you're here and doing the right thing?
Right. I can tell you personally, we have about 2,000 maybe health professionals at the FDA. They're not working there to make money because they could make money elsewhere. They're working there to make a difference and to help people's lives. But for your message for you is we can't alone protect your health. Nothing is 100% safe, not even water. You could overdose on water and kill yourself. So people have to exercise judgment themselves
but
as well.
But they can't exercise judgment about things they don't understand and they don't know. They exercise judgment when they took Vioxx thinking that they were going to make themselves better.
Right. Well, that's why you have doctors, all right, and that's why these are prescription drugs. They are too dangerous, prescription drugs.
David Kessler, you want to jump in on this?
I think for the first time in about a decade, you're not only going to see tobacco legislation, but you're also going to see drug safety legislation. Senator Kennedy, Senator Enzi, there are certain other competing bills with Senator Dodd and Senator Grassley. But I think you're going to see Congress insist that the FDA require the development of what they're calling risk evaluation and management strategies for all new drugs and biologics. And I think that's a good thing.
Go to another question. Mitch from Silver Spring, Maryland. Hello, Mitch. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'm one of those people that uses a drug that's not made for the millions. I have a rare cancer called carcinoid, and I use a drug called Sandostatin. And I have to say that I think, speaking for myself, but knowing lots of other people with the disease I have, the FDA has seriously fallen down.
Why?
The generic approval process for a generic version of Sandostatin took close to 2 years to go through, and when the FDA issued its final ruling, it basically said that the opposition to the generic application had no foundation in fact at all.
Mm-hmm.
But the large pharmaceutical company, Novartis, was able to game the system, make millions of dollars just by paying a few $100,000 in legal fees.
So you see all these conflicts of interest getting in the way of a prompt approval? Is that what you're saying? Is that what you're asking?
Well, not only that, but the criticisms that people who had the disease, like myself, who wrote in on the public record, have been removed from the online record that is kept.
All right, let
so
me...
So now all you see are the application by the drug companies and the opposition by the drug companies, but the letters from the patients saying this is baloney were removed from the online segments.
A lot there. Let me let Janet Woodcock respond.
I think he's saying that he feels that the innovator company was able to block a generic for a long time. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that ultimately, after a scientific evaluation process, the blocking was found to be without merit and the generic was approved. And
yes.
You're concerned that that took a long time and therefore had economic consequences for the patients. When scientific issues are raised, it isn't about conflict of interest. What we have to do is evaluate those scientific issues very carefully to make sure the public has confidence when generics are put out there that they can be used in place of the innovator product.
But this was not a scientific evaluation. What the review was, and if you go back and look at the record on this, the review said that the statistical analysis was flawed.
All right,
that
so
all
what?
It took was literally someone sitting down with a calculator for 5 minutes.
Janet Woodcock, go ahead. Your response.
Well, this has been debated a lot before Congress recently, where the issue of blocking citizen petitions are called, whereby citizens can send in petitions and perhaps delay the approval of a generic drug.
But in this case, the citizens obviously are the large drug makers, and they have been doing this, Frank, for years and years and years and years. This is an old story. It has been going on for a long time. Drug makers make billions and billions and billions by simply delaying FDA approvals, by often bringing up what seem like scientific issues but are basically bogus.
David Kessler, in just a few seconds, because we need to take a break, your response to this, you've heard this time and time again, tremendously frustrated citizens, sick citizens who want a quicker approval process.
They want a quicker approval process. There is a quicker approval process. I want access to any drug that I can get, but if something goes wrong, they then say, FDA, where were you? It's almost the American way. We want it both.
What do you suggest?
Well, I think when it comes to science, I still put my money on FDA. I think it's the finest and most dedicated set of individuals that I know.
I'm Frank Sesno of CNN and George Washington University. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, please give us a call at 1-800-433-8850. That's 1-800-433-8850. Talking today about FDA, the approval process, and what's working and what's not working. Gardner Harris, the FDA, this incredibly big, incredibly important and influential agency, didn't even have a Senate-confirmed leader for most of the Bush administration.
Right.
Why and at what cost?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. First of all, FDA, like a lot of other places, has become an increasing sort of political football on Capitol Hill and even in the Bush administration. I mean, the Bush administration has been very effective at politicizing agencies that prior to this point had not really been part of the normal political realm. The classic example of the Bush administration's politicization of FDA is Plan B. Plan B, which is the emergency contraceptive pill. The morning after pill. It is absolutely clear from testimony that has come out as a result of some lawsuits that there was some direction from perhaps the White House, we don't know where, that the Plan B approval process be slowed down.
Janet Woodcock? From the White House? Did the White House tell the FDA to slow this down?
Yeah, I can't comment on this, and I obviously have no direct knowledge of that.
You have no direct knowledge at the White House? Do you have indirect knowledge at the White House?
I don't have knowledge of that.
Dr. Kessler?
You know, I think that there is certainly evidence that there was, in that instance, interference. But I think the fact is that it's very rare. My problem with that case, if whoever wanted to interfere, I mean, should have said, look, we have problems for a certain moral, we have certain problems for certain other belief reasons, and be upfront. It was interference. It is rare, but it did shake confidence in the agency, no doubt.
Do you have interference, political interference, during your tenure?
Political interference. My job was to put my body on the line between thousands of people who wanted to influence the agency, lawyers.
How about the White House?
So there was a time where I got a list of people that they wanted to be named to a certain advisory committee.
Who was the they? Which administration?
It was in the first Bush administration. They gave me a list of names that they wanted added it. I said, thank you very much. I walked out the room and I threw the list in the garbage.
Does that happen a lot?
I think Dr. Kessler's right. I don't think it does happen. I mean, what really the FDA struggles with is, as Dr. Kessler said, this push-me-pull-you between speed. You know, people want these drugs almost as soon as a drug maker dreams them up in their lab on the one hand, and then they want FDA on the other hand to assure them that it is absolutely safe. More than that, there is also a political battle between those who think that you should basically, that this is a buyer beware system, that you should be able to get access to whatever drug you want, and as long as you discuss it with your doctor, that you should get this medicine. On the other hand, doctors have proven themselves to be not very competent at dealing with these issues. In fact, most of the drugs that FDA has been forced to withdraw over the last 15 or 20 years are drugs that had known risks that doctors continued to prescribe to people even despite those risks. So there is a real push-me-pull-you between speed and safety and between whether you can trust your doctor or whether you should really just trust the FDA.
Dr. Woodcock, what do you say to people who will take Gardner's observation and say, yeah, there is the push-me-pull-you, I want you to protect me, but I'm sick and I need to know that you're moving as quickly as you can, and if you're not, why you're not? How are you communicating with people?
We have to look at the need, okay? And I think people need to realize that the FDA represents doctors. And so we are responding to medical need.
Okay. Coming up, your calls and questions for our panel. Stay tuned.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. Additional support for NPR comes from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities, on the web at wkkf.org. And from the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In a new memoir, writer John Sedgwick describes what he discovered when a nearly fatal battle with depression led him to better understand his complex family history. A story of privilege and tragedy that begins in colonial-era New England. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Thank you. And welcome back. I'm Frank Sesno from CNN and George Washington University, sitting in for Diane Rehm today. We're talking about the FDA and the many things that it's asked to do and some of the things that it hasn't done. Our guests today are Janet Woodcock, Deputy Commissioner and Chief Medical Officer of the FDA, Gardner Harris, reporter of New York from the New York Times, and David Kessler, former FDA Commissioner under both the first Bush administration and the Clinton administration. He's now the Dean and Vice Chancellor of the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. So we've got some emails and plenty of people on the phone lines, and to those of you holding on the phones, we're going to get to some of you now, so I appreciate your patience. But first, here's a very interesting email that we got just a moment ago back on the bovine antibiotics that we were talking about, the antibiotics that are given to our cattle that may or may not have an effect on human health. So here's one. The expert's response on the issue of feeding antibiotics to cows fell short. The issue isn't the treatment of sick cattle. It's the discovery that feeding subclinical doses of antibiotics to healthy livestock makes them grow faster and fatter. It isn't about animal health. It's about pushing agribusiness profit margins to new highs. The choice to ban this feeding practice shouldn't be a difficult one for an impartial FDA. Well, impartial David Kessler, what do you say to that?
The issue in animal health of the FDA is safety, and it is a health question, both the health of the animal and the health especially of the humans who are going to consume the feed from that animal. We have to remember, FDA handles safety questions. That's what it's about. It's not into whether something's good for agribusiness or not. It's what is safe for the American public.
Gardner, in your reporting, you see these cross pressures all the time. What's to that comment?
Well, this is a great story about, to some extent, the powerlessness of the FDA. The FDA has been trying, for 4 years to ban Bayer's fluoroquinolone antibiotic for cattle, Janet? And it sort of started this process, I want to say, in 2001?
Something like that.
Yeah,
Ban it for what reason?
Because of this very issue mm-hmm. about increasing resistance. I believe that antibiotic is a fluoroquinolone.
Yes. Yeah, so,
and a fluoroquinolone is the most advanced class of antibiotics, and there is a consensus in the scientific community that fluoroquinolone should be reserved exclusively for humans.
Mm-hmm.
And here is a drug that Bayer has been selling now for more than a decade, I believe, in cattle. It clearly creates resistant pathogens. It clearly makes this very select class of antibiotics more difficult for humans to use. FDA came to the right decision, and frankly, its process is so cumbersome that it has taken 5-6 years even to get to the point where you all are just about to get it off the market, right? I mean, it's ludicrous.
Well, this process takes hearings. If the company doesn't want to voluntarily remove the drug from the market, it takes an administrative, judicial type of process.
But doesn't that, Janet Woodcock, exactly reinforce the point of the emailer? That in this particular case, the interests of agribusiness, certainly not the interests of the consumer, came first and have dragged this out for years.
No. But that's not FDA's fault. I mean, that is Congress's fault to not give FDA the actual power to get this damn thing off the market.
Yeah.
And it's not only animal drugs, it's human drugs. I mean, there are still questions about whether FDA has the authority to compel sponsors to complete their commitment or initiate new studies of human drugs. That's why Congress is looking at legislation this year.
There's not questions about it. FDA clearly does not have that authority.
So what's needed? What do you need from Congress or anywhere else to make this happen the way it should happen?
Again, I can't comment on that. What I can say is that
you can't comment on what would help the FDA do its job?
What I can say is right now we have to take products off the market, and even that, if the company does not agree, we need to go through the process Gardner described. But to compel companies to complete post-marketing studies, FDA would have to say, if you don't do this, we're going to take the drug off the market.
All right, let me go to the phone to Jim from Arlington, Virginia, who's been waiting patiently for a good long time here with a question about another area of interest. Go ahead, Jim.
Yes, hello. This is Jim Fussell, and I'm calling about the regulation of drugs and dietary supplements. And on the one hand, we see products like Vioxx, which was exposed by David Graham, to possibly be contributing to the deaths of 20,000 or more people. But I'm finding that in the area of a food product, dietary supplements, there seems to be an extreme amount of scrutiny on food supplements, especially recently. And I'm wondering why the pharmaceutical product is, and not just Vioxx but others, have been given such a leeway when food products are scrutinized so carefully.
Dr. Woodcock.
Right. Actually, it's quite different than what you described. I'm not sure where you got your impression. The pharmaceuticals undergo a tremendous amount of scrutiny and have to have an extensive testing before they're put on the market. Dietary supplements, if that's what you're talking about, the supplements that you can buy in health food stores and so forth, have a different regimen, and FDA has to find that they're actually causing harm before FDA would do anything to remove them from the market. But they can go on the market without FDA clearance.
There's actually legislation that Congress passed, I want to say now 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Did that happen during your tenure, Dr. Kessler? I'm trying to remember.
I lost that battle big.
Exactly. The FDA wanted to regulate the safety of supplements and the claims and all that sort of stuff, but there was special legislation passed that essentially protected supplements from FDA. And so now there is an extremely high bar. A supplement has to be shown to be dangerous before FDA can take any action against it.
So, Dr. Kessler, let me ask you this. Here's what I'm hearing. I'm hearing it with respect to the antibiotics that are injected and fed to our cattle. I'm hearing it with respect to dietary supplements, and that is that the FDA and others would like to dig into some of these things, but again and again and again, problems on Capitol Hill within the Congress with the way that this whole roadmap has been put together get in the way. Now, citizens can be outraged about that, but in the end, this is stuck on Capitol Hill. What changes that?
I think it's not just Capitol Hill. I think if you look over the last 6-7 years, the lack of stable leadership, the chronic underfunding of the agency, those are two problems that can be fixed. Strong leadership of the agency, adequate funding, and I think we'll go a long way.
Okay, Janet Woodcock, you've got a new commissioner, Dr. Andrew von Eschenbach. You talked earlier on the top of the program about how he wanted to deal with some of these very things, and we've now come full circle and hear how important it is. How's he going to make it happen?
Well, he is going to put in strong management, strong leadership, and the best possible science. All right. And I think among those things, we can do.
Does that change the dynamic?
It does not change many things we've talked about here. All right. It does not mean that FDA regulates tobacco. Again, that's a decision of the Congress. It doesn't mean FDA has authority over requiring post-marketing studies to be completed. That's a matter of the Congress and so forth. So there are things we can do within the scope of our authorities to do a better job.
Another email. This one is a very interesting one from David Ross, MD, PhD. He was a primary safety reviewer at the FDA for a drug called Ketek. And he writes the following. On January 20th, 2006, the FDA issued a public health advisory on liver failure associated with this antibiotic, Ketek. As evidence of the drug's safety, the advisory cited a study called 3014-3014 that agency managers knew to be fraudulent. Why did the FDA use this study to try to reassure the public?
I can't comment on that specifically. I know the story about Ketek.
Ketek, my apologies.
That's all right. Ketek does rarely cause a liver failure like a number of drugs that are out on the market. There was FDA asked for a very unprecedented safety study to be done before the drug was approved because of concern about this. And some of the investigators in that study were fraudulent.
What's the status of the drug now?
Prosecuted. The drug is on the market in this country and other countries, and it has very strong warnings about liver failure, like many other drugs.
Gardner, this has been in the news lately.
Absolutely. And Dr. Ross actually was an important part of making sure that this drug's label started to get some real warnings on it. And, one of the frightening aspects of that drug was that it was being increasingly tested in children, even though the drug has this other antibiotics certainly have problems with the liver, but this drug causes something close to an allergic reaction where taking just one pill can, in some cases, lead to death. And it is obviously almost impossible to predict in whom that might occur. So an advisory committee was brought together, and FDA has since accepted its advice to put real warnings on this drug, suggesting that it only be used when other drugs don't work anymore.
Does it make you nervous that this has not yet happened, Janet Woodcock?
This has been widely announced and publicized.
Do you think doctors have the information, the patients have the information they need?
I don't know about patients, because they can't sort out one antibiotic from another. This is the medical community needs to have this information. There have been very extensive communications.
Back to the phones now, this time to Lisa from Cleveland, Ohio. Hello, Lisa.
Hi. I have a question regarding the introduction of generics. When a generic product comes on the market, the brand name product basically disappears. And I was wondering if it wouldn't actually help with drug pricing if the patents could last longer, so the drug companies aren't in this mad scramble to make as much money as possible within that 10, 15-year period.
David Kessler, what do you make of that?
No questions that there's a lot of competitive pressures. The industry, I mean, is in a scramble. I think that's why we see as much advertising as we do in this period of time. But there's no question that if the patent will actually keep the price up, the introduction of the second, especially the third generic, does drop the price. But the brand name industry is also in the generic industry, so they're playing both sides of the street.
Okay, and Mark's on the phone and has been very patient from Lake Tahoe, Nevada. Mark, go ahead.
Hi. I heard your panelists say that job of FDA is to make products safe and effective. My question is, how do they plan to make tobacco safe and effective? And another question is...
Well, that's a big one right there. That's a big one right there. How to make tobacco safe and effective?
Right, but I would also like to ask a follow-up question.
Go ahead.
That is,
go ahead.
If they do take control over tobacco, is the public going to perceive that it's safer because FDA is now regulating it?
That's a very interesting question. Very interesting. Janet Woodcock, you want to start on that one?
Well, the point about tobacco is not that it's going to be effective or safe. It's to minimize the risk to the populace.
Now, what about if people think it's being regulated, that they somehow think it's safer?
Yeah, well, you know, I see this with dietary supplement ads on television. They have this little disclaimer at the bottom about FDA doesn't regulate it. Mm-hmm. Everybody thinks FDA regulates them. And that is something that would have to be dealt with.
Or FDA approved. David Kessler, what about that notion that tobacco somehow seems safer if people think it's being somehow regulated?
There is no doubt this product cannot be used safely. The legislation does not set that is the standard. The goal of regulation has to be to reduce the number of people who find this product attractive and to regulate the product itself with regard to its manufacture. But I will tell you, it's the one aspect that I lose sleep about. I worked for 10 years trying to get FDA regulation, and now Philip Morris wants it. And the caller's not all wrong. I think on balance, more lives will be saved if we regulate this product.
Here's a question, an interesting one. Now, this doesn't relate directly to the FDA, but it certainly touches upon some of the things we've been talking here today. This one's coming in from Marilyn in Arvada, Colorado. She says, doctors contribute to the blockbuster drug phenomenon. She says, I'm a super healthy 58-year-old woman, and my personal physicians range from adequate to outstanding. My doctors, she says, have pushed at least 10 or 15 blockbuster drugs on me in the last few years, all of which are advertised on television, including that irritable bowel med, a sleep med, prescription decongestants, and on and on. She says, I've taken none. I'm doing fine. Doctors need to resist the marketing pressures of the drug makers. How much pressure is there on doctors? How much incentive is there for doctors to push these blockbusters on unknowing patients?
Well, Frank, think about all the drug ads you see on TV. That is just a small fraction of the amount of money that drug makers spend marketing these medicines to physicians. Drug makers spend the most amount of money that they spend on anything, they spend on trying to sell these medicines to physicians. And physicians are under a lot of pressure from in an army of sales reps who show up at their door trying to get them to prescribe these drugs.
Let the patient, the buyer beware. I'm Frank Sesno from CNN and the George Washington University. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call us at 1-800-433-8850. And Dr. Woodcock, doctors, pharmaceuticals, blockbusters, what should they do? Actually, more to the point, what should patients do?
People should recognize that all medicines have risk. All interventions have risk, and you should only take something if you've thought about that. The healthiest lifestyle is what your caller said, is don't take any medicines unless you really need them.
All right, let me bring in a caller here on this very topic. We don't have a whole lot of time, so Harvey, you're out of North Carolina, as I understand it. Go ahead with your question, please.
Yes, thank you very much. It was more in the way of a comment. My feeling is, after reading a lot on this topic for quite some time, is that today the FDA is actually irrelevant. The greatest part of their funding, better than 50% of their funding, according to what I've read in numerous articles, is coming from the big pharmaceutical companies. They're also being unduly influenced on the political side from the various political parties.
All right, let me take that comment, such as you've been able to get it to us, because we don't have a lot of time, and bounce that off of Dr. Kessler.
I think the fact is FDA is very relevant. It's the most important consumer protection agency in the world. There are user fees, but in those user fees, I do not believe the evidence shows that they influence FDA's decision-making. They no more influence the agency's decision-making than when you apply to college and you pay an application fee. But we have to be careful. We have to, in fact, get the agency the funding it needs.
Very quickly, Janet Woodcock, in 10 seconds or so, what are the things that people should see that are going to happen or should happen in the next 6 to 12 months to make us safer? 10 seconds.
You'll see more information coming out from the FDA on all these topics to keep consumers and health professionals and everyone else, including the newspaper, informed about what's going on.
All right. To our panelists, thank you all very much. Gardner Harris for your great reporting, David Kessler for your service, Janet Woodcock for being with us here today. The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Ann Adams, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, cassette and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. I'm Frank Sesno of CNN and George Washington University.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 240-horsepower turbocharged Acura RDX. More at acura.com/RDX.